And they asked me, the first question was, do you have any exceptions to abortion? And I said, I do not. They said, well, what about rape and incest? I said, I do not have exceptions to abortion. And they then said, well, what about the life of the mother? Okay, you have an exception for that. I said, I do not. Dana Nessel has come out and said, she will not, if Roe v. Wade is overturned, and I believe it will, she said she will not enforce the 1950s law that's still on the books in Michigan that says that it's illegal to assist in an abortion. And I would enforce that law immediately when I'm elected this morning.
I'm Matt Rush, with me, as always, with Kristen Hogan.
Hey, brother, how are you doing?
Just another giant assault on people's rights to sort of interpret for folks. So, you know, okay.
It's been quite alarming. Yeah, man. I appreciate you spending the evening with us. Matt is a little under the weather.
I feel
strong.
Yeah, that feeling of like, you know, I thought this might have just been sniffles, and you're in a little bit of denial, and then you feel that fatigue hit, and it's like, oh, nope, this is actually. I think it's going to get worse before it gets better. Hopefully, it's not COVID. I've tested, and we tested negative around here, but that's what also my boss did for a couple times, and then he was positive. So whatever it is, you know, I'm going to be a big baby about it, and we'll see. But.
Well, fingers crossed, brother. Well, we have a really exciting interview coming up, too, with Robin from Minneapolis, who is a city council member and independent socialist. We're going to be hearing from her about the fight to bring power to the people in the Twin Cities. I mean, really inspiring conversation. I can't wait to share that with you all.
Inspiring is the word. I'm super happy to talk with Robin. I mean, I first tipped off by her by our buddies over at Money, Power, Land, Solidarity podcast, GP Jacob. But she, like, there's all these talks of, you know, the Democratic Party and how you can get around it and the obstacle it presents. And it's, we always talk about Kshama Sawant. Like, it's nice when we don't have to be theoretical and we can actually be practical about what that looks like. And, I think Robin is a treasure.
Oh, totally. And we got some fun stuff coming up after that. And as always, we would love to hear from y'all in the post game. Y'all can get a head start. We always appreciate it when you do by giving us a voicemail at 1-940-289-7234, 940-289-7234. We always love hearing from y'all in the post game, patreon.com/leftreckoning. So sign up there to get access.
I'll just say we're going to have a juicy post game. I got some stuff to say about this Madison Cawthorn business I don't think we could actually play the tape. that's going out there right now. Maybe we can play the one in the car. But, I just want to make a broader point about sort of that, what that sort of material means. It's a liability for politicians, sure, but before it's a liability, it's sometimes an asset. See Brett Kavanaugh's gambling debts. But anyway, that's for the post game. patreon.com/leftreckoning.
Well, before we get to all that, I mean, we have to talk about this leaked Supreme Court opinion that is making it seem like it's very, very likely that in the next few weeks, for many people, including people in my home state of Texas, the right, and it is a right, to get access to health care and to have an abortion is severely, severely under threat. And you know, obviously there's a lot that's been said about it so far. And I think a lot of us are sort of processing the shock and the fear. And I mean, I'm with y'all with that. I mean, it's absolutely a frightening moment, a moment that we always hoped would never come. But because of the game that we've seen from liberals for decades, has always left this door open for a far right deranged movement that is in power today to be able to follow through on undermining human rights in this country in a really dastardly and devastating way. I mean, we got a lot we want to talk about. We're going to talk about the court, but I think maybe let's just start here. You know, I wanted to remind folks that this has been a sword that has been put over our heads for decades. And yes, there has not always been the opportunity for federal action, but there has been plenty of opportunity for federal action on codifying a Roe v. Wade, making sure that abortion would never be under threat. And this kind of constant kind of pull left and right that we've been sort of living under, and it has been extremely consequential and devastating for millions and millions of people around this country, you know, that they could have avoided this whole thing by settling this question once and for all. And we'll get into some of the things that could be done. We'll talk about the court. We'll talk about some immediate things. But let's talk about the immediate thing that could be done. Well, actually, sorry, before we get there, Matt, if you could put up this fundraiser right quick for folks.
Oh, yeah.
I just want to say right now, because in the aftermath of this, you've seen a lot of people asking for money. And I highly suggest that people, if you are going to be, you know, putting money out there, and I think it's something that you definitely should do, find ways to donate money to organizations that have been making sure that people are able to receive abortions. Those are the people who have been on the front lines this whole time. Those are people who know what to do. And those are the people who are going to use those resources to the best of their ability. You're seeing a lot of Democrats have loved to fundraise off of this, and they've fundraised millions of dollars off of this over the past few decades. And this can't just be something that is allowing them to fill up their coffers until they start taking seriously their responsibility to take action on this. So this is a local one here in Austin. There's a link in the show notes on YouTube if people want to find a way to donate there. But I know across the country, DSA chapters and abortion organizations have been asking for funds. And I highly suggest if you're going to be, you know, giving money out in this moment, that those are the organizations that you're giving them out to. So just a quick plug to start. But let's get to what we should be doing about this. We could get this Bernie line up here because lays it out rather clearly what can and should be done while the Democratic Party controls the House, the Senate, and the presidency. Bernie Sanders said Congress must pass legislation that codifies Roe v. Wade as the law of the land in this country now. And if there aren't 60 votes in the Senate to do it, and there are not, we must end the filibuster to pass it with 50 votes. That's it. That's the game. It's as simple as that. There's a fight that has to be that must be done to achieve that. But that is the game plan in the immediate future for what needs to happen. And remember, you know, Bernie has in the past been hesitant on ending the filibuster. This is somebody who recognizes that the situation is changing. It's dire and something needs to be done, and it needs to be done now. The same cannot be said for the sitting president of the United States of America. Here is Joe Biden in the aftermath of this leaked rule opinion here. This is what he had to say on the matter.
Sir, the president said he'd do away with the filibuster to codify Roe.
I'm not prepared to make those judgments now about, but you know, I think the codification of Roe makes a lot of sense. Look, think what Roe says. Roe says what all basic mainstream religions have historically concluded, that the existence of a human life and being is a question. Is it at the moment of conception? Is it 6 months? Is it 6 weeks? Is it quickening, like Aquinas argued? I mean, so the idea that we're going to make a judgment that is going to say that no one can make the judgment to choose to abort a child based on a decision by the Supreme Court, I think goes way overboard.
Thank you guys.
Overboard. He was a lifeguard. So,
I mean, that is pathetic. That is absolutely pathetic in a moment like this to not have a thought out plan. They knew. Give me a break. This was the whole threat that was being put forward by the Democratic Party in the 2020 election, that you got to rally behind Sleepy Joe. You got to rally behind these folks because the threats are too big. And we need somebody who has the political skills and the political knowledge and the ability to respond to them. This is a guy who's spent his life in the Senate, right? Is supposed to be the expert on how to get things done there, having no plan Other than, I mean, it's not even rhetoric at this point, what he was saying right there. I mean, that was like mad living through a 1 minute spot on one of the most consequential things that has happened politically in the past couple of years. Right. I mean, that is an absolute joke. And the Democratic Party should be ashamed of the situation that we're in right now. I mean, let me take unless you had anything you want to add to that, Matt, like.
Well, only in the sense that like they're not ashamed. I mean, we have this clip here of Jim Clyburn. House Majority Whip says that when he calls Representative Henry Cuellar his friend, he really means it. He praises Cuellar for building bridges rather than hurling insults or avoiding colleagues. Cuellar is anti-abortion. And this is today, Jim Clyburn campaigning with him. One other note on that. So it is Cisneros, Jessica Cisneros, which is the opponent to Cuellar, calls on Dem leadership to withdraw support from opponent, the last anti-choice Democrat in the House. Cuellar has been endorsed by Nancy Pelosi, Steny Hoyer, Jim Clyburn, and Hakeem Jeffries. And I just want to like make special note of Hakeem Jeffries because he's 51, so I think he's a couple decades younger than the other people on that list. But he's being groomed, which is a word that's harder to say these days, but he is being groomed for leadership by these old folks to continue the exact same sort of fecklessness and inaction and cynical fundraising on actual life and death issues that has got us in the position in the first place. Mm-hmm. So Hakeem Jeffries, like, there's going to be a plenty of focus on Pelosi and Clyburn, which is fair enough that like people should hate them and learn to be politically educated through like their limitations. But also I just want people to understand Hakeem Jeffries is like, this party is, it's rotten at the head and the mm-hmm. leadership is just rotten. But like, there's this idea that these folks will die off, and actually, no, they are cultivating the next sort of round of corporate Democrats.
People who are very comfortable with maintaining the status quo. I mean, we say this time and time on this program. And I mean, let me just be absolutely crystal clear here, because I know some people will say, well, why are you talking about the Republicans? What is there to say about them? That is a minority party that believes in minoritarian government. They're not people who are very interested in the fact that the vast majority of people in this country, despite how polarizing it is politically, the vast majority of people in this country want to ensure that people have access to an abortion. That is actually not as controversial as our politicians make it out to be seen.
Yeah.
Right? There are debates as to terms and things like that. We should fight them on that. But the vast majority of people in this country do not think that this is something that the right to an abortion needs to be restricted. That is a very far right, small portion, but a very vocal and a very powerful and a very well organized part of the right wing. But of course, the right wing is willing to play that game. We know this. Right. So why am I'm seething mad at those people. I think that they're pigs. I think it's disgusting. But I'm even more mad at the people who ostensibly are supposed to be there to support these things. Like, we're not even talking about the big game here about, dealing with, capitalism and worker exploitation and those questions. Right. We're talking about just very, very basic, human rights in 2022 in the United States. Right. I'm furious at the people who are leading the assault against it. And I'm even more furious at the people who are supposed to be playing defense, who are sitting on their asses right now. Let's just talk about this for a second before we get to the real elephant in the room, which is the Supreme Court, the anti-democratic relic that continues to poison the system seemingly on a yearly basis now. Let's just talk in like recent memory. Barack Obama gets elected president. We talked about this, last week with Luke Savage, about the kind of historic moment that he came into power with, right? Controlled the House, controlled the Senate, came in with extreme popularity as the country was crumbling during the financial crisis. Had a lot of ability to basically be able to bring and reshape this country in a much, much different direction. And all we saw was compromise and retreat. from Barack Obama, from everything, from dealing with the bankers, from helping out the people who lost their homes, to doing something on healthcare. I mean, Obamacare is a complete retreat and acceptance of, you know, the prerogatives and dreams of the insurance industry. Two, the most basic question in American politics is something every person who runs for office has to answer. What is their position on Roe v. Wade? What is their position on abortion? And Obama, when he ran, took a very, very strong position, saying if he gets elected, he would codify Roe v. Wade. That's a much better situation in the Senate. That's a much better situation politically than we have today. And still, they didn't do it. In 2009, they held the presidency, they held Congress, and it seemed like Obama was ready to go. He promised that the first thing that he would do as president would be to sign the Freedom of Choice Act. But then when he gets into office, it slowly started to sink down his legislative priority. So I don't want to hear people talk about Jill Stein or Hillary Clinton losing in 2016. There was an opportunity there with the mandate, with the position, and with the capability to do it, and they didn't do it. It started way before then, but that's something in our lifetime. That's something only a few decades away now. What, 12 years, 13 years away from us? A golden opportunity to finally settle this, and they didn't take it. I don't want to hear shit about kind of electoral fantasies as to what could have happened. They were in power and they didn't do it, right? We just talked about Cuellar, the fact that Nancy Pelosi and the party right now, who again love to fundraise on abortion rights, at every moment are willing to shut down and try to kick out progressives from the party so that they can maintain relationships with corrupt oil-loving guys like Henry Cuellar. Remember, Henry Cuellar was the only Democrat in the House to vote against the most recent attempt in the House to codify Roe v. Wade into law. Why, if this is the most important fight of our lifetimes, if 2022 is the most important election that we're going to be facing, why is the Democratic Party, as Matt just showed this photograph, flying out to Texas to support somebody who doesn't support the basic legislative principles of the Democratic Party?
Corruption, I think, is the answer to that.
It's absolute joke. You want to put up this lever thing?
Well, I want to make one note on like the failure of leadership of the Democrats, because I don't think it can be under stressed, and particularly right now when like they need to fight or they need to lose massively, and not just lose an election, lose people's faith for a generation, because they have been cynically, and we talked about this with Robin, cynically fundraising on all this stuff and send out very, in rhetoric that emails that meet the moment of how serious this is. Mm-hmm. But also this entire generation never truly, like you talk about Biden, the number of politicians who can't actually say the word abortion in a positive sentence.
Yeah.
And that is contributed as much as, I mean, look, like the right wing has organized massively on this, but the failure of the Democratic Party to come out and make a winning issue a winning issue, and instead constantly like be sort of gross and turned off and sort of feel inconvenienced by it until it's time to turn out the female vote. It's a massive, massive failure. Mm-hmm. And now the moment is like, if you want to be worth a shit as a Democrat, is to understand that and work on doing something else, basically.
No, and they want to fundraise off of it. And I'll just note again for people who are joining us, there's a link in the show notes to fund abortions here, abortion fund here in Texas. That is a much better use of your money than supporting the Democratic Party if they're going to be flying out here to support Henry Cuellar. Absolute joke. Before we move on, and look, I think we have to, and we certainly will happily be doing more on some of the concrete things that can be done immediately. We opened up saying that Bernie needs to show up. People need to follow the Bernie plan and codify Roe v. Wade into law and abolish the filibuster if that needs to be done to do so, which it looks like it needs to be the case. Biden needs to get a backbone and stand up for that position. But there are also things that can be done in the meantime. If you could pull up this Lever article real quick, I just want to note there's a very specific thing that Biden could do today, this afternoon, right? Give him a call and tell him to do this. less controversially, this is from the piece in The Lever, The Roe Disaster and What to Do About It. They break down the history of how we got here. They break down the right-wing money. It's a very good piece. And they break down some very concrete things that states can do. There's going to be a lot of roles that states are going to need to be doing, to protect this right. And two, some things that the government could be doing immediately. So this is from the piece. Less controversially, Biden could use the powers of the Food and Drug Administration to ensure access to the so-called abortion pill. He could do so by seeking to preempt state regulations that limit access to the pill, since drug approval is the FDA's sole domain. That's it. Use the power that you were elected to make sure that people don't have these things taken away from them. Use the full power of the federal government, if Biden were doing other things, I would still be pissed at him, but I would cut him a little bit of slack, right? Because the fight to codify it, because of the people, corrupt people like Sinema and Manchin, it's going to be a fight. But the fact is that he's not even doing the kind of bare minimum things he could do today, other than saying, well, 2022 is going to be a very important election, which is basically what we've gotten for the National Democratic Party at this point. But I highly suggest people read that article if they want to get a full understanding of some of the things that could be done immediately.
Yeah.
Well, lastly, I mean, this is not a small matter. We're going to spend some time on this because this is important. Why are we here? Because the Council of Elders, the unelected Council of Elders in this system, the most absurd relic, anti-democratic relic that we still have today, and they affect everything from abortion rights to our basic civil liberties to our electoral rights, the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court was always set up to be a check on democracy. It was a fear of everyday people. It was the fear of you and me that they created a system that allowed so much power to reside in the Supreme Court. And remember that this power was also taken. The Supreme Court took the power for judicial review. They have asserted the power time and time again, so that very many people in this country believe that the Supreme Court is the highest office, right? It is the end all be all. And there's no reason that should be the case. There's historical precedent for challenging the system. We talked, we've talked a lot with, different scholars about times when, during Lincoln's, when Lincoln was president. Do you think that the Supreme Court was very happy with Lincoln's attempts to end slavery? They were a bunch of right-wing pro-slavery freaks. And you know what Lincoln says? Thank you very much for your legal advice, Supreme Court. We're going to do it anyway, right? The point is that there have been moments in American history where the legislative and the executive branch have said no to the Supreme Court. And I think by far, we have entered into that time today. Let us not forget that the Supreme Court now, the justices who are going to be ruling on this, are people who were elected, who were put into their position, they're not elected, appointed to their position by presidents who lost the popular vote. I mean, where is the democracy in that system? Non-existent. This is a piece by Matt Karp. Highly suggest people read this, how Abraham Lincoln fought the Supreme Court. But let's also remember that it's not just like the ghosts of fucking old presidents like Bush and Trump that threaten us. It's people who aren't even American. If you could pull up this piece in Jezebel here. In the leaked abortion decision, Justice Alito relies on jurists who supported marital rape and executed witches. So heavily cited in the opinion were the legal musings of a 17th century British citizen who argued that women who are married cannot bring claims of rape to the state. And I'm going to quote from this real quick. This is from this guy. For the husband cannot be guilty of a rape committed by himself upon his lawful wife, for by their mutual matrimonial consent and contract the wife hath given up herself in this kind unto her husband, which she cannot retract. I mean, that is the most reactionary, dehumanizing thing you can ever say. What kind of fucking democracy is this? where we're going to let some futile ass motherfucker be able to take away human rights today for people? I mean, this is a clown show. To sit here and act like this is just or reasonable or society based on laws, this is a clown show. This is people who, because they understand that they have the numbers in this unelected body, that they can do whatever they want. And they love to nitpick and find, like, oh, well, you know, some fucking fancy lad from 16th century Britain said some things that sort of back up my argument, right? I mean, there's no legal standing for this. I mean, is this the kind of democracy that you want to be living in, where not only, do you not win if you get the popular vote, but two, we have to have foreign fucking British people from 400 years ago telling us how we should be governing our society today? It's a joke. It's not upholding the right of law. It's not a rational system. It's absolutely absurd to sit here today.
Hale is a guy, just looked at his encyclopedia, who was a jurist during the English Civil War and managed to sort of play both sides. And it was it wasn't clear if he was supportive of the Parliament or the Royals. And sort of interesting why a guy like a Supreme Court justice like John Roberts, for instance, would be interested in. But I mean, and this wasn't Roberts, this was Alito. But I mean, why they might be interested in a figure like that.
No, I mean, totally. And like, look, it's just unbelievable. And like, people who have followed me and the work I've done here on TMBS and other places for years know that I am fervently against the Supreme Court, both in its current iteration, but on its kind of philosophical justification. I'm a big believer in democracy. I think that we should be able to decide these questions as a people, right?
Yeah.
And there is no reason that we should have some high body sitting on top of democracy, shutting it down everywhere we go. From Bush v. Gore to all of the horrible, horrible, dehumanizing decisions against Native Americans, against people who were forcibly enslaved, against women. The Supreme Court has never, ever, ever stood up for the justification that has been added post hoc. By the way, you know, people love, you hear this all the time, Matt, right?
Well, we like, you know, the Supreme Court is corrupted today, but actually it's always been set up to protect the minority from the tyranny of the majority.
Do you know what tyranny they're talking about? Yeah. They're talking about rich people. They have never, like, at every moment in American history, if you can cite a Supreme Court ruling that might, that was in our favor. Do you know where that came from? It came from massive social movements and political movements that completely changed the terrain. So the Supreme Court had no option other than to sort of follow through with what was being demanded in the streets. And you know how they do those rulings? In the most conservative way possible. Abortion is no exception to this rule. Roe v. Wade, for what it has done to ensure people's right to health care, their basic human right to health care, has been seriously helpful. Don't misunderstand me here, but it is the most conservative way to assert a basic human right and agency for women and for people over their health care, right? Yeah. The right to privacy. They find a way to make this as conservative and muddled as possible so that for the next few generations, it can be pulled away and pushed back and challenged and weakened. Right? There's never this kind of triumphant moment that these people who truly say they believe in the system, argue is coming. Beyond that, questions should begin and end in the democratic process. That means voting, that means in the legislature, and that means in the executive branch. I'd prefer much more power to reside in the legislative branch than the executive branch. There is no reason to sit and have people who have lifetime appointments, who are relics of ages past, who also are people who climbed up in a system. We can have a different conversation if you think that the American justice system is any kind of harbor of peace and justice for the people. I think most people listening to this know what I'm saying when we understand that the justice system in this country is a system that has always favored the powerful and the connected and the wealthy. So think about the people who rise up in it and what their positions and biases are.
I mean, look at the outcomes. Massive inequality and number one cager of human beings on the planet. There's your judiciary.
No, I mean, yeah, exactly. I mean, it's let me just, okay, well, what has to be done about it? I think, and I hope, from everything that we've experienced in our lifetime, Matt, and especially over the past few years, that people should start getting sick and tired of debating and hoping that 9 unelected, strange people rule in our favor, that people will start to recognize the court for what it is, a relic of the past, a relic of anti-democratic power, and start to understand. And it's not just anti-democratic, too, I have to note, in the sense of it ruling against, you know, things like judicial review or deciding who gets to be president, you know, based upon who their favorite boy is, as, you know, as we saw in Bush v. Gore. It's also anti-democratic because it puts an absurd weight over every question of democracy in every presidential election. Every single time I voted for president in my lifetime, the first thing that people say is like, well, you might not like the Democratic candidate, but you know what will happen if the Republicans come in? They will put in a right-wing justice, and then the whole train is going to shut down. The whole system can fall and cave upon itself. That's an absurd way to run a country. That's an absurd way to run a country of 300 plus million people. That if something happens once every 4 years and, you know, a bunch of people in the Democratic Party who decide that they want to help push up the appeal of somebody named Donald Trump ends up backfiring on them and they win, that we're now sitting here in 2022 losing rights that have been, you know, basically the rule of law in this country for 60 years. It's absolutely an absurd system, and it's an unrealistic question to ask of the people. What we have to be doing is to be building political movements that not only can win, so we're not getting into the system where like reactionary judges are being put into power, but to a system that is willing and articulate about the fact that the branch of government that is closest to the people, and that is the legislative branch, needs to be able to have authority and to challenge and to pull back the authority of the Supreme Court. People like packing, right? I prefer nullifying the general power of them, at least at the heights, the national heights of government. And if packing maybe leads to people losing confidence in the court, right, and recognizing as what it is, a political institution, yeah, that would be good. But I would prefer just a much more direct one-for-one. This is an anti-democratic organization. And look, I know it seems far-fetched right now. I know there's a lot of things on the table, but this is absolutely this is one of the most important questions that you have in politics if you want to change this system, is to be able to challenge the power of the court. We're not even talking about revolutionary socialism or anything at this point. Bernie Sanders, can you imagine what they would have done to something very milquetoast, very legal, and very cool, like Medicare for All, if Bernie Sanders was elected president? They would have cut that shit up. And until we recognize, it's going to take a lot of effort and a lot of education and a lot of organizing to do it, but until we recognize that challenging this authority of this unelected body is absolutely paramount to doing anything in this country, we will never succeed.
And if you look back in history, like when things like civil rights were passed, this sort of talk was on the table. Like,
yes,
the reason, like, LBJ, interestingly, like, gave the Senate a new lease on life, because prior to him navigating that stuff in the wake of JFK getting his head blown off, people were looking at the Senate and the Supreme Court in exactly those terms. In that, like this is a relic. It has outgrown not only our needs, but like any sort of modern government's needs. And, you know, people are like saying, well, what would you do? Like, I mean, generally, I feel like the general leftist position should be like unicameral legislatures that have supremacy over a judiciary. I think that's, there you go. Like,
no,
if it bounces around courts enough, then it becomes a voting issue.
Man, I mean, the amount of power that the Supreme Court in the United States has is unparalleled to any of the other countries that we typically compare the United States to. It is a unique thing. Mm-hmm. And you have to have trust in the people if you are a socialist or a leftist, and you can never sit here on your hands and say like, well, maybe we'll have some progressive guys in the Supreme Court. So if the right gets power, you know, they won't be able to do anything. Because what ends up happening is the right ends up having power over those kind of institutions because they are inherently, by their very nature, conservative. And it is, you know, very false to sit here and look at American history and not recognize that the court has always played a conservative and tamping down role. But beyond that, I mean, let me just end here, right? First up, for all of the people who are frightened and fearful, we're here with y'all. I don't have the direct answers other than putting the pressure up as much as we can on this. We've been here before. Remember that, you know, when this came into play, when Roe v. Wade happened, it came because not because of the benevolence of the court, but because there was a massive, sustained, brave movement of people who stood up for basic human rights. That's how we got this victory in the first place, and that's how we'll get it again in the future. The second group, especially for what I was just saying about the Supreme Court, your criticism cannot condemn you to nihilism. That is how our opponents win. We cannot accept their framing, and we cannot accept the shitty way that things are run today. You can look at the history of this country and you could say, well, America has never really been a democracy, David. What are you going on about? We need to restore democracy. We need to fight for democracy. Your answer has to be then, if that's your analysis, to change it into one. Not to say, well, things have been bad, so I'm going to accept the thesis of the ruling class. No greater good could come for the ruling class than if the left just lockstep accepts this kind of anti-democratic nature of the American state. Yeah. For too many people, and I've talked about this a lot, a video I did a while ago for TMBS on what I call left pessimism. For too many people, like the realization that the system severely limits democracy, if it's what we're seeing this week, if it's what happened to Bernie Sanders, if it's what happened when they pulled away the popular vote from, you know, the very, very vapid but winner of the presidential election in 2000, Gore. You know, if you come to this realization that the system is severely limited, that's where too many people's analysis ends. They say the system's corrupt, the system's broken, and that's it. Mm-hmm. You can't do that. You cannot do that. You have to fight for, you have to argue for, and build up people's power so that we can live in that democracy then.
Right.
And, you know, making the point, even though it's not been the case that we've lived in this beautiful, thriving democracy throughout our history, making the point that the promise that motivates people of living in a democratic society is being denied by things like the Supreme Court is absolutely important if we want to build up a kind of system that will work better for people. You cannot fall into this trap of nihilism. You cannot fall into this trap of a pessimistic realism. You have to be willing to fight. That's the only way that things have ever changed for the better.
Yeah, I couldn't say it better.
Well, we got some more stuff coming. I appreciate everybody holding on with us, but that was important. I mean, there's just too much tied into that to just give it a once over. But we're going to be joined in just a moment by Raman from Minneapolis, who's going to be talking about just those kind of projects. And I'm really happy to be pairing this interview with the first subject matter, because this is how we build up the power to fight. This is how we build up the power to win. So we'll be releasing that. After that, we'll come back for one segment, and then hope y'all will join us for the post game. Get access at patreon.com/leftreckoning. Leave us a voicemail if you have anything to say about that, maybe. At 1-940-289-7234. We'll play that during the post game, patreon.com/leftreckoning. Last week we did a really great reading from Marx on the thesis, his thesis on Feuerbach. We got the cool stuff coming up this weekend, and we'll see y'all in just a little bit.
Yeah, sorry, I'm falling apart
a little. I know. I appreciate you soldiering through, Matt.
All right, this is a great interview, and go follow at Robin for the number MPLS. Give her some love on Twitter. Here is that interview. Welcome back, Left Reckoners. I'm Matt Leck. With me, as always, is David Griscom.
How's it going, brother?
It's going well, and we're excited to be joined today by Robin Wansley. Robin is the first Black Independent Socialist City Council member representing Ward 2 in Minneapolis. I mean, there's a lot to get to just in that introduction there, but Robin, welcome to the show, and why don't you introduce yourself a little bit and let us know how you became a socialist and why you decided to turn that those beliefs to electoral politics.
Ooh, all of that in like, what, 30, 40 seconds?
Just got as much time as you need.
Well, no, thank you so much, Matt and David, for having me on. I always love following your show, especially, you know, one of the few spaces where you elevate like leftist and real leftist politics. So thank you so much for having me on today. As you shared, you know, I'm Councilmember Robin Wansley. I have the honor of representing Ward 2 specifically on the Minneapolis City Council as its first independent Black Democratic Socialist. And it's so challenging to pinpoint where specifically, you know, when I woke up one day and was like, I am now a socialist. I would really just have to say, like, growing up in a country and cities, especially, I want to know for me, like, I've, you know, spent all of my adult life and childhood living in democratically ran what was supposed to be liberal cities. You know, I'm originally from Chicago and then moved to Minneapolis as an adult, as, you know, as my next hometown. So again, what's supposed to be these progressive liberal abysses. And it's also the places where I've experienced my family, my friends and loved ones, especially those that look like me, have experienced some of the grossest forms of just injustice, you know? So I would say, like, my journey to socialism came from life. You know, living in the South Side of Chicago, one of the most racially segregated cities in the country, then moving to Minneapolis. And, you know, there's extensive documentation that constantly positions Minnesota as one of the worst states for Black people in particular. And one of the worst states for any type of, you know, economic or racial and inequities in the U.S. And all of that has just shaped my daily lives, going to schools that were constantly under the threat of closure, living in subpar housing, but still having my mom, having my wages, you know, go down while rents are going up, having to spend from the age of one, like visiting prisons, you know, because many of my loved ones end up being in rapture from the massive crime legislations that the Democratic Party championed in the late 90s and early 2000s. So really, you know, I became a socialist because of life, and also because there's not really any other choices. Like, if I don't want these circumstances to exist, you know, where these are the only material conditions that Black and brown people and women and non-binary people have to constantly tolerate, these conditions of exploitation, of violence, of dispossession, then socialism was the only thing that I came to learn about that provided a way forward where we can actually, as working class people, as Black and brown people, take land, take resources, take our wages, take everything that's extracted from us back into our collective ownership. And away from the need to divide us, away from having us to engage in harmful and violent relationships with each other. We could take all that back and actually create systems, create relational ways of being with one another that actually support our collective well-being, that supports our collective material needs, and not have profits be at the core of that. So to me, like, socialism has been really like, what's the other choice? Because I've only lived under racial capitalism, and I can tell you this system is hot trash. It is flaming garbage. It flames every single day. There's a crisis every single day. And for all of the wealth and all of the billionaires and trillionaires that we have, many of our everyday, you know, issues cannot be resolved under the system. So for me, this provides the only way forward towards something better.
Yeah. Oh, go ahead, David. You going to say something?
Oh, no, I was just going to, I mean, like, I love hearing that so much. And I do have to say that, like, you know, there is really no better education than life for getting you to, you know, take these commitments seriously. But I wanted to sort of ask and frame it in the sense of, you know, your run for city council. And you know, could you take us through that sort of timeline and what, you know, brought you from the position of like, all right, I have these views about the world, I feel like something needs to be done, to then, you know, filling out the forms and the paperwork to be on the ballot to run for office. And the second bit, which is something we always try to ask, you know, elected officials who, you know, are socialists, like, you know, there's the two sides of the electoral question, right? There's the first bit, which gets a lot of attention, like, how do you win an election, right? Very important. Mm-hmm. But as you know, it's like the real work starts the second that you show up in the office. So you sort of have to navigate state and government power and find ways to, you know, one, be successful, and two, to show up for the people who elected you in the first place. But yeah, could you talk to us a little about the decision to run and how you're mm-hmm. using the office, you know, to benefit people and also build a kind of stronger socialist movement, both locally and maybe even, you know, across the board?
Yeah. So the first question about, you know, how did I get to this place of running? There's two specific events that really shaped that decision. The first was my early introduction into organizing in Minneapolis in 2015. That was actually shaped by two movements. Black Lives Matter movement, which had just started to you know, come into fruition here in Minneapolis. Unfortunately, after our Minneapolis Police Department executed a young Black man by the name of Jamar Clark, that prompted an 18-day occupation outside of our fourth precinct. And this is also happening alongside the Keystone Pipeline organizing, but also that intersected with another growing movement here, specifically around workers' rights, but particularly the fight for 15. So for me, again, you know, growing up in Chicago, I know policing happens in largely Black working class communities that happen historically underinvested in. So we have this movement for justice for Jamar Clark happening in the fall of 2015, and then the Fight for 15 movement happening also simultaneously. And to me, it made sense, you know, to link both of those fights. We're talking about increasing wages for what is largely, you know, low wage workers. They're disproportionately working class Black people, but also are living in communities that are overly policed, and leads into situations like what we were dealing with Black Lives Matter, like you being making contact with the police and maybe even being killed by them in the midst of that contact. So when I was asked to join that movement, the Fight for 15 movement, it was just like, this is a brainer of like connecting these two. But in that process, that's where I got to see the limitations of liberalism, like in its full on scale. Again, at that time, Black Lives Matter, workers' rights, real booming. We had the most diverse city council at that time. It was supposed to be like the most progressive of the progressives. And when we approached every council member and the mayor in 2015 and said, will you get behind a $15 minimum wage? Most of them said no. They was like, this will, you know, send businesses out of our city. We'll become an island. Civilization as we know it will crumble. No, what are you talking about? Maybe we can talk about $11, maybe $12, but not $15. It was just like, are y'all being for real right now? Like, Black people are dying. Like, you have a police department that we spend millions of dollars in settlements on. Like, what are you talking about? You can't guarantee $30,000 to, like, ordinary people in our city. That's too much. That will kill us. That's a problem. So having to then fight what was supposed to be a liberal city council for 3 years. I mean, they sued us to prevent us from putting this on the ballot. Like, it was a drawn out fight to win, you know, $6 billion, I think is what total from what we move out of the pockets of shareholders, you know, into the pockets of low wage workers to win that and make Minneapolis the first Midwestern city. At that time, people was like, you should run. Like, and I was organizing as a socialist, both on the Black Lives Matter front and within Fight for 15. And we were the independent arm of that movement that would call out the Democrats to be like, you can't talk about racial equity in one sense and then say you support poverty wages in the next. That's a problem. Wasn't ready to run at that point. But fast forward to 2020, the world watched our police department once again lynch a Black man publicly. And I thought back to 2015 to be like, why in this liberal city where we have progressive, quote unquote, or diverse representation, why are we constantly in this same predicament? Now to the point that we have sparked a global uprising, like cities around the world are on fire because we have failed to address the deep inequities of violence, of exploitation here. But yet we like to pat ourselves on the back and say we have progressive representation. That's not true. And in the wake of seeing the absence of our leadership, I'm talking about, you know, at the beginning days of the uprising and being like, I can't sit on the sidelines anymore. Like, I could not imagine in that moment moving forward, you know, angry that the movements that I've had the honor of being part of that have fought tooth and nail, many of these progressive council members and leadership for the most bare minimum concessions, I cannot sit on the sidelines and watch them be denied again without trying to intervene, without trying to do something. And it became very clear that the voices of our movement have been completely absent from City Hall. And that gets at the next question that you raised. Like, that's exactly why I came into City Hall. I thought of, you know, during 15, if we only had one city council member, just one, who made the effort to bring forth a minimum wage policy, or if we just had one council member that was willing to take on MPD head on for the past 5 years, and called out to question how, you know, corporate agents in our city and the capitalist class wants to continue to keep Black and brown people and working class people in subjugated positions. Like, if only we just had that one person to be a voice to amplify the needs and demands of working class people, what difference that could have made. And 2020 crystallized that for me, that I needed to step in spiritually. I wanted to be there. I did not want to continue to be on the sidelines. I didn't want to continue to see that absence within City Hall. And you're right. That is where the work has come, you know, really starts to take place, because now you're transitioning, or for me as an activist, to elected official. And what, as an independent socialist or any leftist, you're immediately going to be attacked about, you're going to be attacked on your ability to govern. So that has been the biggest piece of, how do I balance this commitment to working class struggle, to a socialist future, to a socialist praxis with governing? And governing is the way that they try to trip you up, to say, like, you're not prepared. Your activism, your activism is causing more divisiveness, you know, because we're raising very clearly the political inequities, the economic inequities that's taking place within City Hall, and how City Hall and local government is used to propagate these status quo systems. We're calling that out. And I'm as much as stressful as it is, because I'm literally behind enemy lines. We're literally talking about, like, local governments are used to uphold, like, the interests of the capitalist class. And I'm here as an insurgent, like, the pressures to fold, the pressures to be silent, the pressures to be pushed out is very real. But if I wasn't here, I could not imagine just how farther disconnected this space would be from working class people, especially being the first administration since George Floyd's murder. And unfortunately, you know, a month into my tenure, seeing another Black man be executed, Amir Locke, while he was sleeping. And not only I have to echo this too, like, I'm not only grateful that I get to be here, I also get to be here alongside two other socialist council members. And I worked on Ginger Jetson's campaign in 2017, who was also looking to be the first independent socialist here. I also worked very closely with Ty Moore, who ran also to be an independent socialist council member in 2013. There was a world where in Minneapolis, we couldn't even imagine having one, you know, independent council member, to now we have three socialist council members and one as a Black independent socialist council member. So I'm glad that I'm not here by myself, bringing the movements, the demands of our movements, into a space that has been inherently oppositional to those movements, to really reshape our political terrain to advance working class struggle.
Yeah, I just want to ask you a little bit more about that. You chose to run as independent socialist as opposed to the dual track endorsement where you get a socialist endorsement and the Democratic Party one. And, you know, I just want to shout out GP Jacob of Money, Power, Land, Solidarity podcast. Like, I think his perspective on this is right. It's like people run on the dual track. Like, I like that. I want to see them win. When the independent of the Democratic Party, it's a little bit more interesting to me. But I just want to hear your experience running and winning that way. And, yeah, like a little bit of now you don't have the Democratic Party like to sort of get your back on some of this stuff, how that's playing out now you're in office.
Yeah, I think it was always clear to me from the beginning of like, as an abolitionist, I don't just extend that to like prisons. I extend that to every, you know, system that governs working class people lives. And politically, I think of our party system, are the only options that we're given as working class people are the Democrats and the GOP. And again, my life experience, having been raised in cities that have been predominantly raised, I mean, governed by Democrats, also growing up in a period where from federal to state to city, all Democratic elected leadership. And again, experiencing the rise of some of the most historic social movements because conditions, material conditions have worsened so greatly. Like, to me, it was just like, oh, these are two sides of the same coin. Like, they're mm-hmm. both, you know, operating with the same goal of preserving and protecting the interests of the capitalist class yeah. in our society. And one just has a better PR machinery. They make it look like racial capitalism can be inclusive of, you know, all of our respective identities and ethnic backgrounds in our communities. And the other one just says, actually, you all can die. We don't care. It's just better PR on one. But y'all all aim to, like, make sure that U.S. Bank is straight at the end of the day. Like, you all want to make sure Jeff Bezos ain't got to pay no more taxes that he already don't pay to working class people. So for me, in abolitionist practice, like this was an opportunity to show for working class people. And actually we got a glimpse of that with Bernie Sanders' 2016 run. I mean, I know he ran as a Democrat, but it was very clear he was mm-hmm. not the Democrat's choice. And they did everything and they did successfully end up blocking him, but he essentially ran an insurgent campaign. He ran basically independently. And we saw that working class people were excited about his vision around this political revolution that prioritized the 99%. And many of these working class people were part of unions and all sorts of organizations that was typically attached to the Democratic establishment that were going for Hillary. We saw rank and file, ordinary working class people reject that and go behind Bernie. So Bernie mm-hmm. campaign actually showed an opening that working class people, when there's a candidate that is in lockstep with our demands, with our interests, their support to build political infrastructure behind them. Mm-hmm. And to do so without these political parties that often work against our interests. And I think we wanted to demonstrate that here in Minneapolis. And fortunately, in my race and in my ward, who preceded me was actually a Green Party candidate. Shout out to Cam Gordon, who, I mean, we still have a great relationship. He's an advisor of mine, but he was the longest serving, you know, Green Party in the U.S. And he represented my ward for 16 years. So we already had this embracement of political diversity here. Mm-hmm. So me coming in, it wasn't like, ooh, what? No, social, like, no. so, you know, for me, it was like, okay, there was an opening there in my ward, but also opening to show that working class people do not need to tie themselves to political parties, especially here in Minnesota, where we actually have a history of the DFL. There was a Farmers Labor Party. Like, we've known at many points that the Democrats was trash, and we've sought to organize ourselves separately from them. So here's another opportunity to build a political, independent political power. And of course, we faced resistance from the DFL. They took our van data early on. They sent in a corporate back challenger after us. Like, we had to do a recall process. Like, they're gonna go after you, and it's because we had the support and backing of working class people that mm-hmm. I get to be in this position and co-govern with them. And then, yes, that second part of the Democrats now being in office, how to navigate with them. I like to use the example, you know, after Amir was killed on February 2nd, I believe it was on February 3rd that I went to our full council meeting and called publicly for the resignation of our mayor, Mayor Fry. I can do that because I'm not beholden to a political party. I can do that because I've been in lockstep with our movements, especially those fighting for a city that is not constantly held hostage by a violent policing system. And know that much of the protections around that system as it stands right now in the status quo, most of that has happened under the current leadership of our mayor.
Yeah.
And I had no issue with calling that out. Many of my colleagues are worried because we're in a 2-year election cycle right now. They're thinking of like, well, I might need his support, or like, you know, I can't do that because I'm going through the party process. I'm not worried about that. I'm worried about how are we delivering better conditions, material conditions for working class people? How are we making sure government is actually prioritizing the needs of working class people instead of our downtown council, instead of the chambers of commerce? And these are people that the DFL or Democratic Party seeks to partner with time and time again, seek donations from. And it's just like, no, they're class enemies. Why would I? No, we're not BFFs. And it's nothing personal. I just know what you're here for, and you're not here for my people. So, yeah. I mean, has that, I think there's a degree of freedom that I get to have in actually holding the left flank of our current political environment. I'm not beholden to our state party politics. I ain't got to deal with none of that. If I have drama, it's drama because I called out your relationship with class enemies that I know is hurting working class people and making demands on you with working class people to do better. I'd rather have those problems.
and I mean, it's no, I mean, it's nice too that you don't have to spend or waste time, frankly, you know, being forced into fundraising for people who you know are actively working against the policies and programs that you want to put forward, which is one of the difficult things that even independent, you know, Democratic Party members have to deal with too.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we raise every single dollar on our own through like talking to ordinary people. And I, again, that just shows, I hope we're a walking reminder that people do not have to, you know, just the trash, the crumbs that they're given. I mean, I know we're going to touch on this on the Roy versus Wade case, but how many decades have that been under attack? How many iterations of federal and local government has been under Democratic leadership? Like right now, we have that in Minnesota. There's a law in the books that they can pass right now that makes it so that Minnesota is a sanctuary hub. And we have a Democratic governor, a Democratic House.
Yeah.
And a Democratic like city, one of the largest cities in the state. Bruh, make it happen. Fight for people. Like just do it.
Yeah.
The Republicans understand the assignment all the time. They are in lockstep with Nike's slogan, just do it. How about y'all get that same energy?
Yeah, also, they have no problem with doing that shit in the minority, let alone exactly. the big majority is Democrats after a while. You want to ask about?
I want to ask about something else quick that kind of occurred to me. So, you know, we talked when we had GP Jacob on. He called Fry the sort of perfect neoliberal mayor, and that he'll like sort of present well, and then you know stab you in the back. And the other thing that you have, I know about Minneapolis. I'm from North Dakota. Is you have a whole lot of corporate headquarters there, and then on the other side of things, you have Amazon walkout by a bunch of workers who wanted their pay raises to be continued to be honored and time off for religious holidays. And I also saw you were supported the Augustana staff union. So talk a little bit about your role as a socialist elected and this rise in union activity we're seeing and what you think about that generally and what you think your role is there.
Yeah, I have to know prior to coming into this role as city council, I worked as a labor organizer for our statewide teachers union. And I did so because politically, like, you know, while there's many critiques that I have of unions, especially in regards to their relationship to the Democratic Party, which often stalls how they can deliver better, you know, outcomes and better conditions for their rank and file members. I mean, it's one of the few institutions that we have that are intentionally governed and self-sustained by working class people. It's an independent institution to challenge, you know, this hostage situation that workers have to endure under the system of racial capitalism with our bosses. So, you know, I to me as a socialist, if you're really talking about like building for the liberation of working class people, and thus from the system of racial capitalism that relies on the class property owners, or basically the capitalist class who all owns the means of production, like really are about like freeing ourselves from that, then you have to support institutions that focus on working class people, that are ran, that are governed by working class people, and unions are it. And we're seeing a rise of that in this historic moment of I would say late stage capitalism, where we're seeing working class people, and I mean especially for millennials, raise your hand if you're a millennial, like we was the last generation that was like promised the sun, milk and honey and everything. It was like, you know, Obama was out there being like, go to college, y'all, and you're gonna be good. You are gonna be good. You're gonna have that house, the picket fence. You want two dogs? We ain't gonna give you one dog, you get two. And then the market crash. It was just like, wait, what? So I'm broke? I can't buy a house? Like, wait, what? Also, all this debt. Where all this debt come from? You tell me I was going to have to spend the rest of my life paying off debt. Like, we're literally here at this late stage capitalism where millennials was like all the way due. We was told if we did everything right, go take on extra debt and then go into a job market that pays like slum wages, like we would be straight. And we're not straight. So we're seeing, I think, a very rightfully so, this rise of workers who are not only organizing, but organizing in sectors that I would say traditional unions have really stepped back from. You know, we saw the retreat of, I would say, you know, traditional unionism in the early 80s, late 90s. They really led a retreat from a militant like politics and unionism. And we're seeing the rise of that again, thankfully so, by workers who have likely never had any contact with traditional unions. I think of like Chris Smalls, of course, like that man employed like real militant, not only tactics to like win over those workers, but he did so under like a militant politics. The man was reading or the organizing team was reading what Trotsky and Lenin, like they were reading a Marxist politic that guided their organizing, because they understood who they were up against, who their class enemy really was. And we, that is so detached from like traditional unionism right now. Like you can't even talk about Marx. What? No, what? No, don't say those words. So I think we're justifiably seeing this rise, and I'm really excited that Minnesota, Minneapolis specifically, has also been, you know, at the forefront of this larger labor movement. You know, just several weeks ago, we had our teachers lead a historic three-week strike, which they haven't done since 1970s. And they inherent, like, explicitly called out, you know, the ways in which philanthropy, the divestment in public education comes from like the capitalist classes, specifically those headquarter corporations that you named. Like we went out during their actions towards different headquarters, like U.S. Bank, like we named who are responsible for us not being able to have nice things as working class people. So I'm really, really excited to see that working class, that Marxist, that socialist politics is also accompanying this rise of militant and diverse union organizing that's happening in so many different sectors. I love that part of like from service industry. Several years ago in 2020, we saw a rise of union activity among service employees, our waiters, you know, our servers here in Minneapolis. Then we saw that spark of fire amongst nonprofit, you know, employees. Now we're seeing that in my ward with, you mentioned, our university employees. Augsburg staff union just recently formed, and they're leading an amazing fight against their, you know, private liberal arts institution for a better contract. Like, we're recognizing that capitalism or your bosses is not going to give you shit.
You have to demand it. It's something else. I know somebody who works for Target, and you know, they've been under scheduling, so there's not enough people to do the work, and apparently it's because they don't have enough money. And I look at the most recent earnings, and $1.54 billion. So I don't know. Oh. I don't know why exactly they're unable to find the money.
And I also know when we were 5 for 15, like one of our partners met with like some of the leaders, shareholders and executive leaders at Target. And they were initially the main ones, but like 15 would kill us. 15 would kill you of all people? 30?
Yeah.
What? And now what their starting wage right now is like 20 some dollars an hour, because don't nobody want to come work for y'all for like poverty wages. So they got the money. Mm-hmm. Don't give your CEO a bonus for like 5 years. They'll be straight.
It's like one of those things. I can't remember what plant. It was UAW, but I can't remember what car company it was. And it's like something in like the 50s or 60s. And the company was saying like, oh, well, we need to slash wages to, you know, because we're not as profitable as we want to be. And the union came back and they said, well, let's look at the books. And if you started like, we can find some places where, you know, we can probably make some cuts that aren't to our wages. It didn't end up happening. It ended up, unfortunately, like leading to more crushing of those unions. But it's like that kind of mentality is like, you know, we're pretty smart folks out here. Like if you are saying that, like, you know, the math is neutral and we can't control the math, let us give us a little shot at look inside of those books to see if there's some fat that we can cut off before y'all start telling us about like the divine logic of the market.
And I think that's where, I'm sorry, I didn't answer that last part of the question of like the role as like a socialist elected leader. It's like, we should be amplifying that. Like for me, when the teachers announced that they were striking, and then also we learned that there were a Starbucks location here in Minneapolis that was looking to unionize, that saying we recognize like it's important to link those struggles together, whether you're serving a latte to someone in the morning or teaching someone kids. Like, you are workers who deserve a dignified workplace, and you deserve respect, and that respect should be translated to your pay, to your benefits, to how you're treated, you know, towards the racial environments that you have to deal with. Like, that should be reflected there. And as a city official, we should be saying, any businesses that do work here, that's the threshold. You need to be prioritizing the needs of your workers. So we actually moved to pass a resolution in support of our striking MFT workers at the time, as well as our Starbucks workers, like using this bully pulpit that we have to amplify the movements and the organizing that's happening that our workers are leading here. So, you know, I think that was another opportunity that we used to leverage, you know, this role. But also, like, I'm a policymaker. Like, we have a wage theft policy here in Minneapolis, but often the issue comes around enforcement. So one of the ways that, you know, my office is recently trying to figure out, how do we let folks know that you can come to the city and report your boss if you think they're stealing your wages in through actual just like not paying you or through your benefits. Like, you can report that to the city through a co-governance model. So we've partnered with workers' rights centers who do a lot of recruitment, a lot of outreach. And one of those instances, thank you to Rock Minnesota Restaurant Opportunity Center. They actually worked with a group of students who was working at a Blaze Pizza in my ward and contacted the city, because they was like, my paycheck's been short. Something's not right. And then the city ended up doing an investigation and found that Blaze Pizza has stole more than $30,000 from those students. Jesus. So, like, even having, you know, the policies that we have here that's supposed to be protecting workers from 15 to earn sick and safe time, making sure in my oversight capacity, like, we're funding staff to carry out those investigations, to enforce them, and to pass newer policies. Like, 15 is actually dated. We should be looking at, you know, upping that right now. If Target can pay $20 million, we should be looking to have a standardized policy that reflects that. So looking as a policy role, how are you passing policies or legislation that's truly meeting the needs of working class people as well? So I think that's also a key component of how we can use the seat as socialists to really meet the needs of working class folks.
I mean, that's really beautiful. The idea that someone's experience of their government would be their government looking out for their paycheck, as opposed to, you know, like the, I mean, let's move to policing now. You know, you've already touched on how motivated your sort of run has been by the Minnesota Police Department, which has been emblematic for the sort of racist and murderous and systematically, like, just against civil liberties approach that these departments take. There was a new report released by the Minneapolis Department of Human Rights. Where are you telling your constituents we are with the Minnesota police, and where do we need to go?
I've started with the latter. Where do we need to go? Because where we're at is not working. And I mean, it's sad. I know that report was pretty damning, but it also served as confirmation for many, you know, residents who actually thought that this police department, this policing system that we have could be reformable. It could be redeemable, that we don't have to looking at public safety solutions that go way beyond policing. Like we don't really need to invest in that. We could just work on fixing what we have. And that report, I think, helped solidify, like, no, no, no. And I think for me, you know, I've been very clear that we need to be investing specifically in unarmed public safety services that is going to uphold the highest standard of quality and ethical services for all of our residents, to make sure that there is standardized accountability policies that governs our public safety workers, that are going to be enforced diligently by, be it us on the legislative side or by, unfortunately, the mayor, which I've been very clear. When it comes to police, the mayor has sole authority over that. And there is nothing in their way that bars them for exercising the legal authority that they have to implement reforms and restructure or transform a policing department from what it's currently operating as. Now, if they don't do that work, that's a question of political will. And that's not my political will. But like, I've been moving, at least on the council end, for creating a new Department of Public Safety. And this, you know, this conversation has been happening for the past 2 years. We had, you know, the very high profile public safety amendment campaign, Yes on Two, that happened over the past year and a half, that unfortunately was defeated on last November, that would have allowed us to have a new Department of Public Safety that would have got rid of the staffing minimums, because that's even come out. It's like, there's no, you know, police, we don't need more police. We need a different rearrangement of how we're staffing public safety workers to meet the actual comprehensive needs of our residents. But it would have got rid of that. And most importantly, it would have changed oversight structures over our public safety system, so it will be shared between the mayor and city council. Mayor and the corporate elite of our city, the chambers of commerce, downtown council, said, nah, we don't need that. In fact, we need to put more power into the hands of the mayor over all of our departments, even though he has a documented history of just failing so so egregiously when it came to just the one department, the police department. So that got struck down. A mayor got killed on February 2nd. And even before then, my office has been, you know, very public in our calls to the mayor to create a new Department of Public Safety, that it prioritizes the expansion of unarmed services, that focuses on mental health, domestic violence, sexual assault, all the areas of services that our current police department does not tend to. So after Amir Locke, you know, was murdered, one of my council members and I introduced an amendment to basically create that new department on the legislative process. And really invest in this new model of delivering public safety services to our residents, and hopefully create a new standard in which the world will recognize us for, because folks are knowing Minneapolis now based off of propaganda of like, oh, that's police violence, like police violence central, or, oh, now that's just like crime haven. Everybody is a criminal there. So those are kind of the two kind of narratives that shape Minneapolis. Here's the opportunity to show that, no, we learned our lesson. We actually want to do better when it comes to public safety, and we're not going to invest in what's been well documented is not working. Unfortunately, apparently we have leaders who don't think working class people, especially Black people, still don't deserve nice things. And the mayor actually, as of last week, directed most of our council members to kill our proposal for creating a new Department of Public Safety. And it was timely because literally the next day that Department of Human Rights article came out, and the benefits of being an independent. I called that out. Like, whatever proposal you had, Mayor, that includes MPD, this invalidates this. It's time to put a new department back, a new department of public safety back on the table, and one that actually invests in unarmed services, that invests in real accountability over our public safety workers. And we don't have any time left. Like, we don't have time for you to play games. Council can lead this work up now while you figure out what you need to do with this consent decree and getting MPD together. But we should not be continuing to be held hostage by the dysfunctionality of our police department and not be allowed to invest in what actually works.
Yeah. It's really wild, these sort of waves of reaction. You know, it seemed like 4 or 5 years ago there was maybe, I mean, you see the Democrats, they paid lip service to defund and all that stuff, right? And then now you look at now and everybody from that sort of class of people can't help but like throw defund under the bus or this or that and say, we need more police on every corner. And, you know, they should be, you know, doing chores for you in the house or something like that. Like,
it's real. Go teaching your kids. You got a teaching shortage. It's okay. We'll send the police there.
Like. Yeah. Fully armed. Yeah. We got two more topics. I know we've gone a little bit long here, but I do want to ask, you know, we talked with Jake about the rent control in St. Paul, and then my understanding was Minneapolis was also looking toward a similar policy, hopefully as ambitious. Where are we at with housing in Minneapolis?
Oh, it's still trash. Summary of it, still trash. Still cost burden. So, yes, on November, one of the highlights of our elections was question three, which would have given council members, the authority to move forward with creating a rent control policy. That passed overwhelmingly. What's hilarious, though, is that our mayor, his name very clearly, he opposes that. He also is like, I don't think just because the voters said they want that, that we need this. And of course, that translated to majority of our council members who are like, do we really need to talk about this? And because of the pressing of our office, along with our, you know, socialist comrades, we made it very clear that like we're not doing nothing this term without rent control being on the books. Mm-hmm. Like, we need to pass rent control. And we've named very clearly, it needs to be the policy that has been implemented in St. Paul, right next door, 3%, no vacancy decontrol, and universal. We don't need exemptions for big developers. Like, they're not going to struggle from this. It's like 15 PTSD again. They're like, rent control is going to drive all the developers. A 3% cap? Really? That's really going to drive them away? Maybe they should go. But like, we've been very clear, you know, that's the policy. That's the strongest policy right now in the country, and we should be following suit. Several weeks ago, we had, instead of passing just that policy, majority of council members voted that down and decided to do a work group instead. We love work groups in local politics. And that work group will be charged and stacked with stakeholder groups, one including the Minnesota Multi-Housing Authority that dropped over $4 million to defeat rent control. They get to be part of this work group to create the policy, hopefully for 2023. We already know that work group main charge is to create the weakest policy possible. Mm-hmm. So my office will be again, in lockstep with our movements and renters and working class people on the ground, making sure that, you know, they're on watch and that the strongest policy needs to be recommended from there. So that's kind of where we're at on rent control. The efforts to water it down as much as possible is underway. But I think it's also important, and we saw, you know, rent control has to be complementary to so many other fights and really moving us towards this vision of having equitable, non, you know, profit driven housing in our city. So to us, that's a fight for public housing. We need to be investing more public dollars into the construction and maintenance of public housing. And cities should be looking at, you know, what mechanisms we have to direct more public dollars towards that instead of privatizing public housing. My office is excited about exploring what a vacancy tax can look like. You know, we have so many of these high-end developments that's being built in our city, and many of those units are sitting empty or being used for short-term rentals that are expensive as hell. Like, no, you do not get to just build vacant units in our city while we have a growing homeless crisis too. And we're also saying it has to be coupled to that to a robust, humane response to our unsheltered residents. We need to be looking at how we're not just doing an eviction model, which is apparently the way that Eric Adams and Mayor Jacob Frey think is the way to go. We need to be making sure that we're investing in transitional, quality transitional and permanent housing, and using public dollars to do so. So we think that has to be, you know, connected to a broader, you know, robust working class housing program that my office is excited to be, you know, working with a number of housing advocate groups with leaders like Jake, and moving that forward, in addition to rent control.
Right on. And then finally, news of the week is really this leaked draft. I don't know who leaked it, but a leaked draft of an announcement by the Supreme Court gutting Roe versus Wade. What is the socialist response to this? Because I think everyone's a little bit maybe disillusioned by the liberal response.
I don't know if this is the hood response or not, but I'm like, fight. Fight.
Yeah.
I'm like, this is the thing. Like, how do you think those things happen? People did mass protests. Like, things, like, got really bad. Like, in terms of, like, people taking direct action to make those things happen in the first place. And we see the conservative right wing, you know, movement be unbothered by all the extra noise. They are going after their assignment, like, full steam ahead in eroding and attacking all of these civil protections that social movements fought diligently for, that people die for, people, like, let's not even ignore, people rioted, like, held whole uprisings for these basic protections that have now been overturned. And I think what we often hear as a liberal pathway is like, well, let's lead the appeal process. Like, that's on the table. Like, we need to appeal the decision from the Supreme Court, and through litigation, we'll you know, make something happen. There should be mass protests right now outside of every state capitol, outside of the Supreme Court. Actually, where are they playing golf at? Because there's no way you should be able to make that decision and then go play golf or enjoy dinner with anyone. And you should be uncomfortable for the next several days. And so much so that you go back and do your job and, like, overturn this bullshit ass decision that you made. But, like, there should be massive mobilizations that happens right now. And I know there's a lot, again, around litigation. It's unfortunate that also the only thing on the table, this is something my office is going to be exploring over the next several days, you know, how to make Minnesota or Minneapolis is at least a safe harbor. But that, like, I'm really excited to explore, but that needs to happen with, you know, our state leadership at the forefront. And once again, we have a Democratic governor. We have a Democratic House. I find the Senate is trash. Sure, we'll concede that to them. But our governor for the past like 24 hours have been like, if you vote for me, because elections is November.
Yeah,
I will make sure Minnesota will remain a safe space. How about you do it now? And you know what is really something that grinds my gears? Like, I went to a constituent event today and Walz sent out a text message to, on the campaign side, to, you know, people. One of the attendees had it. And I was like, does that text say, does it have a donation link? And it did. They're like, donate first. I'm not going to do it now, even though I have authority and I'm in office right now. I'm not going to do this now. I'm not going to pass the legislation that you didn't even have to do the work for. External groups have already drafted up the legislation. They just need you to put your John Hancock on it and sign it and say, I don't care what you guys say, GOP in the Senate, we're doing this, fine, fight me, cool. Like, it's signed. Like, that's all you need to do. And you're like, nope, let's wait till November. Let's wait for things to get really bad so you can vote for me in hopes that things will get better and drop me a donation while you're at it.
Yeah.
Like, no, no. Yeah. So I'm excited to hear that there is mobilizations happening now. For instance, at 5 o'clock, I'm attending it at the Hennepin Government Center, where one of the leading pro-choice groups are going to be holding an action. I know there's one tomorrow that's going to be at the Capitol. Like, this is a time where, you know, if there was ever a need to bear hug your Democrats and the governors who is on your side to be like, you need to deliver now. We are not waiting till November. Under the guise that you might do something. We already saw how that played out with Biden. We got promised a lot with student debt, with voter rights, with Build Back Better. We got Build Back Nothing. Like, there's been nothing. You are going to actually do something for working class people and do it now. So
and not just fundraise off of them their concerns.
I was like, are you being for real right now? Like,
yeah, I mean, the DCC chair, the Sean Patrick Maloney was going off about that. They're like, we are mad and we're feeling very bad, but remember, it's all about November. Yeah, it's like, no, y'all have like the control. There are plenty of things that you could do, immediately to protect this right. And two, how about we start taking much more seriously, I think, the real democratic threat in general that the Supreme Court, is, right? Like, you have a bunch of unelected elders who get to decide what laws we have in this country with no reflection of, like, what popular sentiment is on that. That's, to use your language, trash. And, like, we got to, we got to be doing much, much better at, like, not just, like, being able to fight these, like, immediate desperate fights are right in front of us, but like also reminding people, it's like, this is the context where this shit happens. This is them trying to take away one, your individual rights, but also your democratic rights to decide what world you want to live in. A hell of a lot in front of us, Lord.
But we're not alone. And I mean, to me, again, like, I see this as, it's fucked up. I'm going to acknowledge that all of this is messed up. It's nothing about this feels good. Every single day, it feels like there is something burning on fire. There's a crisis that needs to be attended to. Welcome to racial capitalism. That's the conditions that working class people have to suffer under. And it gets tiring that we're always fighting for something. We're fighting against someone or something for something better. And I think the thing that gives me hope of, like, even again, being in this position now, I just 6 months ago to go from, we would never imagine having one socialist, let alone an independent, like, elected leader, to having three, like, that's all through working class struggle. And I think we're in a moment where we're redefining what struggle looks like for us. And that is necessary to build the different world that we're trying to create. I think, you know, there was those struggles that took place in the 40s, the 50s that built up to many of the civil liberties that we are seeing being attacked every single day. And I think we need to be, especially on the left, and as we're engaging with those who might not be where we are politically, we need to reflect on lessons from that. Like, those things are crumbling for a reason. And how do we build something that's actually going to sustain, the future that we're all committed, a future where, no, we don't have unelected people making decisions over our lives, which is just capitalism in itself. If it's not the Supreme Court, it's a shareholder who gets to determine how much of your wages you get to take home. Or it's a landlord who gets to dictate how much of your wages do you pay them towards rent. Something that should be a basic necessity. So I think this is an opportunity for us to really think, you know, if we have all these influencers over our lives that we don't elect, that democratically don't represent our interests, how do we collectively start to identify that, dismantle that, and build for something better in its place? And I see people commit. The fact that I still see working class people showing up every single day. And I think the uprising was a real important testament of that. Like, literally, the city, the state ran away. The city was burning. We know what the hell was happening. And in this absence, I saw neighbors who ain't never spoke to each other in 20 years. White folks who might have thoughts about, like, certain communities, like, built their own self-defense committees. They built medic groups. They built food distribution sites to tend to everyday people needs. And it's moments like that that gives me confidence that we're going to be okay. It's going to be messy. It's going to feel bad. We're going to get lots of bruises in this chapter where we're at. But we're going to come out better because we're navigating this together, because we ain't got no choice. So I feel that gives me the hope that I need to be able to navigate and bear witness to all of this mess that we're having to endure.
Absolutely. Well, Robin Wansley, at Robin, the number 4 MPLS on Twitter. I mean, you have the biggest, if people can't tell already, the largest endorsement we give out here at Left Reckoning. Where can people support you in the future?
Yes. Please come check out Robin for Minneapolis, and minus the 4, but Robin forimpls.com. We have a podcast up there as well where we get to talk to local leaders and some national leaders too about how we're all working together in this movement for a world that's free from racial capitalism. If there's ever opportunities you want to also have me come out and speak or, you know, attend actions, you know, if y'all got any connections on how I can get out to New York and kick it with Chris Smalls and they whole crew at Amazon Labor, like, please, I will fly myself out. Like, I'm down to support and join working class struggles all over outside of Minnesota so that we can come back and let folks know we're not by ourselves. There's a gang of us that's ready. So, you know, check us out at Robin from Minneapolis. And yeah, bring me back, Matt and David. Like, this is great.
Anytime. We had a lot of fun.
Thanks so much, Robin.
Thanks, y'all.
Well, hell yeah.
You can, yeah, see why we were so excited to share that interview with you. I mean, we were talking about it in the sort of chat off air, but that final bit of positivity, I really relate to that. Like her, even in the face of all this shit, like it's all this shit and it's all new and it's all sort of same as it ever was and the fight sort of remains the same. So I could tell people were going to be inspired by that.
No, I mean... just going back to my thing, like I love when we frame these things about freedom too, like, you know, what freedom do you have when your landlord is controlling how much of your wage you have to give them, how much freedom do you have when your boss is telling you what to do, all that kind of stuff. I think is very viable, and I think she puts it very well.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, at Robin for MPLS, go I want to see that follower come. She needs more than 5,000 followers. I mean, we need to get those numbers up as a leftist.
Let's get these numbers up, folks.
Exactly. So I want to touch on something. Our boy Charlie Kirk is across my radar again. I want to play this clip of the debate he had with Socialist College Professor Ben Burgess. that's the headline of this. And it's interesting to me because Charlie's done something this week that I really appreciate, which is... be honest about the most fundamental disagreement we have with our enemies on the right, which is the tyranny of the boss. But what's so interesting is that he did that after he sort of makes these attempts to sort of seem like he's against, well, the oligarchy. So here's a clip from his debate with Socialist College Professor Ben Burgess.
And wisdom to try and fix things that matter, things that objectively matter. And I've been really looking forward to this discussion. I hope it's more of a discussion than a debate, because we will disagree on plenty. But when you talk about an untouchable oligarchy, I completely agree. I think that there is an untouchable oligarchy in this country, both corporate and governmental, scientific and technological, that is crushing the everyday common man. Where I think we're going to disagree is that I think the end goal, the thing that we must strive to, is family formation, family protection, and that's...
Yeah, anyway, blah, blah, blah about that. But so against oligarchy, interesting. Now, we got this new clip from him on his radio show, or the Charlie Kirk show, where he has a very similar, people have pointed out, very similar logo to what AOC's was in 2018. But here's Charlie Kirk, and I mean, this is our favorite topic on the show, or one of them, how the need to discipline labor is a fundamental for politics. And Charlie Kirk just admits it here.
And so, but what we're about to experience, though, is people that believe that their dollar is getting cheaper and that it's not worth continually to engage in the economy because they feel as if that sword of Damocles is going to fall at any time. This time, it seems like it's by design. That's a separate issue. But to answer your question, yes, I do believe that we are heading towards a recession. I don't want that. I pray that does not happen. I pray for all of you that will be losing your jobs. So what you're going to see is that these companies that have just hired dramatically are then going to have to scale down. For those of you that are employers and have to deal with kind of the smug, snarky attitude of people that are showing up late and you're like, I got no leverage because I can't find anyone to work. The only benefit of a recession, which is hard to even believe there would be one, the only benefit is that employers are now going to kind of get some of their leverage back because everyone's going to be begging for a job soon. Everyone. So you go.
That is where right-wing populism will always lead you, folks. Yeah. Saying, oh, I guess there's a silver lining, though, of we get to discipline these smug,
uppity employees,
lackadaisical layabouts that won't earn me my fucking money.
Yeah. I mean, it is always funny where the oligarchy ends and, like, sorry, the oligarchy begins and the people end, right?
And the main thing the oligarchy does is not tell you to stop being racist. The main thing the oligarchy does is compel you to work your fucking life away for their profits. And yep. Anybody that like leads you astray from that is probably working for them.
Well, I mean, that's what's, I mean, you know, the one gift that Charlie and I mean, gift, the one, you know, the one nice thing about Charlie is he has to speak so much. That you get to see how far his thought actually goes, because Ben certainly, you know, took him for a nice stroll during that debate. But also here, right, this is somebody who just, you know, a few months ago was talking about how he truly agrees that there is like a corporate oligarchy. And yet sounds very much like the Applebee's executive that we played a little while ago, who was celebrating the coming recession because they were going to be able to cut wages and force people to work longer and harder. Right. I mean, how far away from the corporate oligarchy could you
get? Our bar rescue buddy, too. Remember, he's like you got to discipline a dog by keeping him hungry overnight.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's true. And, like, it's so funny that, like, I mean, because Kirk, you know, he's a performer. And he wants to sort of, like, ride the feelings of the crowd. And, like, you know, some level of, like, Trump stuff allowed them to sort of seem like they were standing against, like, the system at large. But out of power, they become nothing but cheerleaders for capital. And two, like, it is so funny. I mean, I do love, you know, when Charlie tries to think constructively. But sitting here, like, trying to talk about, like, oh, the next recession is coming. Well, you know who else makes those arguments? Marxists. In fact, it's actually one of the key criticisms of capitalism that Marx makes is that the production cycle always trends to collapse. Because eventually you go into levels of overproduction, which drives down the amount of money you can sell products for. And then the entire system has a funding collapse. Now, capitalism tends to, in the modern era, get through that through big government spending to basically, you know, beat the business cycle. But it's not some kind of radical or unusual thing to say, oh, recession might be on the way. In fact, it's something that Papa Carl, you know, a couple hundred years ago, laid out extremely clearly and has been shown absolutely correct from the past 250 years yeah. of capitalist hegemony, right? You know, the real radical thing, if you want to be a radical right winger, is to say that we finally figured out the business cycle and, you know, the recession or the downturn will never come. And those people are constantly proved incorrect. So Charlie, I mean, Charlie's dipping his toe a little bit into the, you know, the left-wing philosophers here.
Well, that's what's so funny about, you know, this idea that Marxism is such a weird sort of thing for people to grasp. It's basically follow the money, right? Yeah. And like this sort of intuition that Charlie has that maybe this is going to be some sort of planned thing that is going to benefit powerful people. It's like, yeah, motherfucker, go back 150 years. Like,
well, Well, that's the point. That's the point about Charles. He can't go much further. Like, he can give an opening statement, which is, well, I think the oligarchy is a problem. Throw in some weird stuff about technology, I guess, and scientists. But, like, that's as far as he can get, because once you start to make him stand on his own two feet on his own analysis, it crumbles very, very quickly. Because, you know, the right loves to create the shadow room of, like, oh, a bunch of people secretly are controlling this society, you know, which is bullshit. The people who are controlling the society are the people that you probably have the most contact with is your fucking boss. Yes. It's the corporations that are extracting money from you. It's the landlords, right? Like, these are the people who are running the society. It's not some big grand conspiracy. And that's why he has to sort of rely on this kind of clandestine language. Because when he speaks clearly about this, he shows himself to be what he is, a spoiled brat who's very worried that daddy is not allowed to, you know, boss around the employees as much as he likes, is looking forward to the day when labor is a little bit more quiet.
Yeah, Absolutely. Those smug. I mean, get a watch, you laborers. Clock in on time. It's yeah, exactly.
Lord, I mean, and for fuck's sake, you know, the irony is it doesn't matter when you show up because you get in trouble both ways, as we've seen from the way Starbucks is trying to wage war on their employees. You know, they're firing labor organizers for showing up to work too early.
Yeah.
Or staying too late. Right. So, you know, you can never really win by their logic either. There is no kind of universal, get up and go mentality that capitalists will accept. They just want to be able to arbitrarily control your life.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It is so funny. Like, and this, the Charlie Kirks of the world invent all these sort of reasons to hate the Clintons that aren't their sort of like so participation true. In like corporate Illuminati. Like, it's so true. It's so funny. All right, folks. Well, post game, I'm going to dish a little bit about Madison Cawthorn. I don't think we're going to play the videos, but I'll describe them maybe. Talk a little bit about. What else we got? Let's put up the phone number.
Yeah, we want to hear some phone calls from y'all. Matt and I are going to do a segment that we probably could do each week, which is We Told You So. And we're going to be talking about the collapse of the NFT market, too. So a lot of fun in the post game, plus questions and calls. Give us a ring at 940-289-7234. We'd love to hear from y'all. Just so you know, I know we should figure out a mailbox map, but just so you know, you just get a beep and you go when you give us a call. But see y'all in just a little bit.